Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am in Nehemiah chapter 5. I'm going to do the whole chapter in this audio, verses 1 through 19, and I'll entitle the chapter, Nehemiah Helps the Poor. Our context is this, of course. Nehemiah is rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, having been sent to Jerusalem in 445/444 B.C. by the Persian Emperor Artaxerxes I. In chapter 3, we saw Nehemiah rebuilding the wall, assigning each portion of the wall to be built by certain people. And then in our last chapter, chapter 4, we see progress continuing on the wall despite much opposition from the pagan neighbors surrounding the city of Jerusalem. Nehemiah took military precautions and kept the bad guys from storming the city and ruining the wall, and ruining the city for that matter. So we start now in Nehemiah 5, 1 through 4. Now there was a great outcry of the people and of their wives against their Jewish brothers, for they were those who said, "We, our sons and our daughters, are many. Therefore let us get grain that we may eat and live." There were others who said, "We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses that we might get grain because of the famine." Also there were those who said, "We have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards." Now what caused this great outcry that's mentioned in verse 1, this great outcry? Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown puts it this way in their eloquent 19th century prose, quote, "Fatigued with hard labor and harassed by the machinations of restless enemies, the majority of them poor, and the bright visions which hope had painted of pure happiness on their return to the land of their fathers being unrealized." Now, who were the people crying against? The pagan neighbors? No, against their Jewish brothers, verse 1. Who were these Jewish brothers? As the pulpit commentator and everybody else says, these Jewish brothers were the richer Jews who had been lending the poorer Jews money in return for mortgage security. They were lending money on the land of the people. In other words, the people being distressed because of the famine were mortgaging their property and getting it foreclosed on. Now, I have a question. Why should Jewish lenders be blamed? They're just performing an economic function. Isn't this just like when people in the Middle Ages would blame Jewish bankers for lending money? Then all kinds of anti-Semitism developed. These Jewish lenders didn't cause the famine. They didn't cause their Jewish enemies to interdict the supply of food coming into the city. They were just helping people out through a hard time, right? Well, the answer to that is, when Jews were poor, no usury was allowed by law. And I'll quote you that law in just a minute. And so these Jews were violating God's law, which was designed to keep the Jews together in times of distress. Now, verse 2 says, "For there were those who said, we, our sons and our daughters, are many. Therefore, let us get grain." Now, as John Gill points out, these people weren't complaining that they had a lot of children. It was considered a blessing to have a lot of children. They were just pointing out that they needed a lot of food to feed all those sons and daughters. I think that's interesting because today we would say, "Oh, the person's got too many kids," instead of saying, "How can we help the father of that family make enough money to feed all those kids?" Now, why were the people mortgaging their fields and their houses and their vineyards? Why were they mortgaging their real estate just to buy food? That's not a normal procedure. Well, it's because of the famine. The prices must have been sky high because of the famine, and so they would have to sell their houses in order just to get a little food to eat. That's bad business. Those are extreme conditions. Now, when was this famine? Well, Adam Clark suggests as a possibility it was the famine spoken of in Haggai 1:10. Now, if you recall, Haggai and Zechariah were the two prophets urging the people to build the temple. The foundation was built in 536, and the temple was not restarted until 520. And so right before 520, Haggai starts saying, "Rebuild, rebuild." Well, this is 445. Between 520 and 445, or 444, that's a long time. It can't be the same famine, as John Gill points out. Another reason there might have been a famine is there were so many people that came in from the exile that there were not enough fields cultivated for such a great number of people. Well, the people had come back in 538. This is 445. Maybe Clark meant a great number of people coming from Nehemiah's entry into the kingdom, but I'm not aware that there were a bunch of people arriving in Jerusalem with Nehemiah. Another theory as to where this famine came from is that perhaps there were some unseasonable rains, rainstorms that had reduced harvest. We read in Ezra 10:9, so all the men of Judah and Benjamin assembled at Jerusalem within 3 days. It was the ninth month on the 20th of the month, and all the people sat in the open square before the house of God, trembling because of this matter and the heavy rain. That was 14 years earlier. Ezra came in 458. I don't think a famine is going to last that long because of heavy rains. Jerusalem was surrounded by enemies. Israel was surrounded by enemies. Judah was. And all around, these enemies would be intercepting all provisions coming into Jerusalem or coming into these cities. So it was probably because of the external oppression that there was a famine. Or maybe it was just because the weather was bad in 445, 444. At any rate, there was a famine. Some of the sad effects were the famine. The people couldn't get food. Their fields were being mortgaged and lost to the richer Jews. They had to borrow money, giving their land as security to pay the king's tax. That would be tribute that's owed to the king of Persia. Adam Clark says that tax likely was not very heavy, but it was during times of distress and famine, so even a light tax would seem heavy. John Gill mentions incidentally, that the priests and the Levites and the Nethinim, the temple servants, were exempt from tribute paid to Persia. I don't know how he knows that. I don't know if it's in the scripture or not. But at any rate, for all these reasons, the Jews were upset. Nehemiah 5:5, now our flesh is like the flesh of our brothers, our children like their children. The people speaking are the poor Jews, and their brothers are the rich Jews who are lending them money. And what the poor Jews are saying is this: we are of the same family as the rich Jews. We are Jews just like the rich Jews are Jews. Our children are Jewish. Their children are Jewish. We're all in the same family. So why are they doing this to us? Continuing with verse 5, yet behold, we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters are forced into bondage already. And we are helpless because our fields and vineyards belong to others. Now, why were the poor people forcing their sons and daughters to be slaves? Because not only were houses being sold for debt, but sons and daughters were being sold for debt. And that's what they did back then. They got in trouble. They would sell their family members for slaves to let them work off their parents' debt. Now, this was allowed legally in times of extreme necessity. As Adam Clark says, we read in Exodus 21:7, if a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. But again, that was in times of extreme necessity. This is not a normal situation where you would sell your children into slavery. Now, this slavery was mild. It was still objectionable from the point of view of the fathers, but it's mild compared to a lot of slavery. As the NIV Study Bible points out, the slavery was only for the period of the balance of the loan. Once the loan is paid off, the security, i.e. the slave, i.e. the son or daughter who is a slave, the security comes back to the debtor, the father. And as the NIV Study Bible points out, the slave did not necessarily have to leave his or her household. There could just be a collateral interest in the collateral would stay home and not go to the creditor's household. I guess the slave would be subject to the beck and call of the creditor. If the creditor says, okay, you're not going to pay me back, I'm going to take your son or your daughter into my house, it would be leverage over the debtor. If the debtor knew that his son or daughter might be subject to be taken at any moment. And another reason the slavery was mild, besides the fact that the slave did not have to necessarily leave his or her household, is because the slave had to be set free on the sabbatical year. Every 7 years, all slaves were freed. So the slavery is over if the loan was over before 7 years, and if the loan was over 7 years, the slave would be free anyway. Well, all that's fine and dandy, but nonetheless, it's not a good thing to have children sold into slavery, and so the poor Jews were complaining about it to Nehemiah. Now we might ask the question, why are daughters specially mentioned here, singled out for mention, instead of just say, why couldn't the Jews have just said, we are forcing our children to be slaves, but instead they say, we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves. There's a possibility that the reason for that is daughters were sold first, before sons were. If the parent got himself into a bad financial situation, why were daughters sold before sons? I just speculate. Maybe sons were more economically valuable in the household, and the father needed to keep the son to help him harvest the crops, etc., to do farm work. Daughters did housework, and so you can live without housework, but you can't live without farm produce because you would starve, and so maybe daughters were sold first, and maybe that's why sons and daughters are mentioned here separately. In verse 5 it says, some of our daughters are forced into bondage already. The daughters are broken out there, as opposed to sons and daughters. In other words, our daughters are gone and our sons are coming next. And we are helpless because our fields and vineyards belong to others. Why? Because the creditors were foreclosing on the fields and the vineyards and taking them away from the owners. We go down to Nehemiah 5, verses 6 through 8. I, that's Nehemiah, became extremely angry when I heard their outcry and these complaints. After seriously considering the matter, I accused the nobles and officials, saying to them, each of you is charging his countrymen interest. Notice that Nehemiah first seriously considered the matter. He just didn't fly off the handle and accuse the nobles and officials willy-nilly without having his evidence marshaled and at hand. So each of you is charging his countrymen interest, Nehemiah says. So I, Nehemiah, called a large assembly against them, against the rich nobles, and said, we have done our best to buy back our Jewish countrymen who were sold to foreigners, but now you sell your own countrymen, and we have to buy them back. They remained silent and could not say a word. Now Nehemiah accuses them of charging the countrymen interest. He did not accuse them of making a loan, because there was nothing wrong with making a loan. In fact, there was nothing wrong with commercial loans. But loans to the poor had to be interest-free. If it was a loan because of an earthquake or a famine, which is where they were here, those loans had to be charity loans. The principal had to be paid back, but no interest could be charged on those loans. We read that in Exodus 22, verse 26. If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you are not to act as a creditor to him. You shall not charge him interest. Notice, to the poor, this is not a business loan. This is to poor people for charity. Leviticus 25, 35 through 37. Now in case a countryman of yours becomes poor and his means with regard to you falter, then you are to sustain him like a stranger or a sojourner that he may live with you. Do not take usurious interest from him. Now you notice in verse 35, if in case a countryman of yours becomes poor, this is a charity loan. Continuing with Leviticus 25:36, but revere your God that your countrymen may live with you. In other words, that he may not die. You shall not give him your silver at interest, nor your food for gain. So the Old Testament law took care of poor people, and these rich nobles and officials were not taking care of the poor. And by the way, this should not be a slam against all rich people. Abraham was rich. He was never condemned for being rich. It's a slam against rich people who are not taking care of the poor. There are lots of rich people who give a lot of money to the poor, and there's nothing wrong with that. I say that because there are certain political, secular animals, i.e. socialists, who love to go around saying it's a sin to be rich. Now, of course, they're usually flying around first class on airplanes, got $23 million mansions, while they rail against wealth in society, which just proves that they're hypocrites. But there's nothing wrong with attacking rich people for particular sins of selfishness or greed. It's a sin that rich people are quite prone to. But that is not the same thing as saying that having money is sinful, because it is not. And it's easily provable in Scripture that it's not. Of course, we don't want to go to the other extreme and say that it's a positive spiritual good to be rich, like the name it and claim it, blab it and grab it, mark it and park it, confess it and possess it, scream it and redeem it, folks say. So Nehemiah calls an assembly, and the assembly is said to be against them. The whole purpose of that assembly was to publicly nail these usurers for their sins. Now, who was in this assembly? Probably the poor people who were being oppressed. Probably there was a large body of people there who were not guilty of being oppressed or lending money. They were not involved, but they were there as witnesses. And also probably an assembly of judges who were assembled to judge the case. Now Nehemiah tells the assembly in verse 8, we have done our best to buy back our Jewish countrymen who were sold to foreigners. Now the we there might refer to Nehemiah alone. He might be using the royal we, especially since he's a big shot Persian official. That's the way I took it, but it could be Nehemiah plus others, maybe Zerubbabel in 538 when he first came over, Ezra who came over in 458 B.C., they might have been buying back Jewish slaves who were sold to foreigners, but let's just say it's Nehemiah. Nehemiah has done his best to buy back his Jewish countrymen. Well, when did he do this? Could have been when he was back in Babylon. He bought some exiled Jews out of slavery while they were in Babylon, and while he was in Susa. He wasn't in Babylon. But at any rate, the exiles were not in slavery to Cyrus. Isaiah 45:13 says, I have aroused him in righteousness. I, God, has aroused Cyrus in righteousness, and I will make all his ways smooth. He will build my city and will let my exiles go free without any payment or reward. So the Jews were not in slavery to the king of Persia. They might have been in slavery to individual Babylonians, and of course that slavery is likely a lot worse than the slavery in Israel. And Nehemiah apparently had been spending his money. We're going to see later that Nehemiah was a wealthy guy. He was trying to buy Jews out of slavery. He's contrasting his activity with that of the rich Jews in Jerusalem who were now putting Jews back into slavery. You're selling your own countrymen into slavery, and now I think is referring to Nehemiah, I've got to go buy them back out of slavery again with my money. Ooh, powerful, powerful speech. They, the rich nobles and officials, remained silent and could not say a word. They were nailed, dead to rights. That phrase there in verse 8, we have to buy them back, that shows that Nehemiah is actually thinking about buying Jews out of slavery again while he's in Israel. Well, the assembly remained silent because the usurers knew that Nehemiah's words were unanswerable. They knew they were wrong. They didn't even try to defend themselves. We go down to Nehemiah chapter 5, verses 9 through 10. Again, I said, the thing which you're doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? And likewise, I, my brothers, and my servants are lending them money and grain. Please let us leave off this usury, this interest-taking. Why, in verse 9, is Nehemiah concerned about the reproach of the nations, our enemies? Well, he knows that the nations will mock the Jews, saying that the Jews don't care for each other. So he's not only worried about the poor Jews, he's worried about the reputation of the whole nation. And that's understandable. He's a government official. He's the leader of Israel, the governor. Verse 10 says that I, my brothers, and my servants are lending money. Now, I'm not sure who his brothers are, maybe his relatives, his servants. Maybe they are lending out of government surpluses. It could be his official Persian officials that are under him that are lending the Jews money and grain. I'm not really sure, but he was taking care of the poor while the rich nobles were foreclosing on their property and taking the poor brethren's children into slavery. Large contrast there. Now, of course, when Nehemiah does this lending in verse 10, he's not charging interest. Again, there's nothing wrong with lending money to poor people and demanding that it be paid back when the emergency is over, as long as you don't charge interest. Nehemiah 5:11, Nehemiah tells the creditors, the rich creditors in the assembly, return their fields, vineyards, olive groves, and houses to them immediately, along with the percentage of the money, grain, new wine, and olive oil that you have been assessing them. Now, this was a violation of contract, was it not? It would be unconstitutional under the American Constitution, I suspect. But Nehemiah was governor, and he had the right to do this. This was an emergency situation. Some had thought that this was the sabbatical year, and they would have to return their fields, etc. anyway, but I don't think it's necessary to suppose that. This was an emergency situation. Nehemiah had the right to force compliance with the law immediately. Not only the collateral went back to the debtors, but also the interest, the percentage of the money, grain, new wine, and olive oil that you have been assessing. That's the interest. Now, NIV Study Bible and Adam Clark say that the interest was at 1% per month, 12% annually. I don't know how they get that number. If I was going to live to 150 and have time to look it up, I would try to figure out where they got that idea, but it doesn't really matter. 12% is fairly high. Of course, percentage rates depend on a lot of things, inflation, etc., etc. But if there's no inflation, you typically don't take 2 or 3% on a secured loan. This is 12%, assuming that the NIV Study Bible and Clark are right. So that's pretty high, especially in a famine. Nehemiah 5, verses 12 through 13 says this, Then they said, the creditors said, We will give it back and will require nothing from them. We will do exactly as you say. So I called the priest and took an oath from them that they would do according to this promise, that the creditors would do according to this promise. I also shook out the front of my garment and said, thus may God shake out every man from his house and from his possessions who does not fulfill this promise. Even thus may he be shaken out and emptied. And all the assembly said, Amen, and they praised the Lord. Then the people did according to this promise. In verse 12, Nehemiah calls priests in order that an oath might be taken from the creditors. What were the priests there for? Well, they administered the oath to the nobles and rulers. And of course, the nobles were the wealthy people and the rulers were the political leaders. And I'm sure there was some overlap between those two categories. So the oath is taken and then Nehemiah shakes out the front of his garment. Adam Clark says that's a frequent action among the Hebrews. It's a great symbol. May God shake out you usurious creditors from your lands. If you don't do what you say you're going to do and give all the foreclosed property back and all the interest back. Nehemiah 5:14, moreover, from the day that I, Nehemiah, was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, who ruled from 465 to 424, for 12 years neither I nor my kinsmen have eaten the governor's food allowance. Now, Nehemiah in verse 14 is trying to show how liberal he was with the poor as contrasted with these rich creditors. He said, I had a stipend, a food allowance coming from Persia, and I didn't eat it. Gave it to the poor instead. So that's his point. He did this for 12 years. Now let's look at some time frames here. From the day that he was appointed, Kyle and Delitzsch say he was appointed in 445, 444 when he arrived. We know he arrived in 445/444. How do we get that? Well, that was the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, as it says here in this verse and another verse too. We know that King Artaxerxes started ruling in 465. You take 465 minus 20 and you get 445, which some people say is 444, but that's close enough. However, some people say he was not appointed when he first set in Jerusalem, but that he came to Jerusalem, rebuilt the wall in 52 days, went back to Persia, went back to Susa. King Artaxerxes said, good boy, Nehemiah, you did a good job. And so now I'm going to appoint you as governor. And then Artaxerxes then is said to send Nehemiah back to Judea. Well, that's nice, except that trip back to Susa is not stated in the scripture. And people controvert that. Here's what the Cambridge commentator says, quote, the Cambridge commentary says that the existence of this unstated return trip is, quote, much disputed, unquote. So I'm going to assume that he was appointed governor from the get-go as soon as he went, that Artaxerxes the First appointed Nehemiah as governor. So he was governor there for 12 years before he returned to Persia in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, which would be about 433 or 432. Now, for Nehemiah to be so liberal toward the poor and not take what was owed to him by the Persians, we have to ask the question, how was Nehemiah supported? Well, here are some options from the NIV Study Bible. Option number one, Nehemiah was wealthy when he left Babylon. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says this, quote, as he declined on conscientious grounds, Nehemiah did, to accept the lawful emoluments attached to his government, and yet maintained a style of princely hospitality for 12 years out of his own resources, it is evident that his office of cupbearer at the court of Susa must have been very lucrative. Well, that's Jameson Fawcett and Brown's idea. I think that's probably true. Some other options, as the NIV Study Bible mentions, is that Nehemiah could have been using money that was still in the city treasury at Jerusalem, collected in previous years when times were not so bad. Another possibility is that Nehemiah was receiving subsidies from the Persian capital. I'm not sure what the NIV Study Bible means by that. It could be subsidies from private Jewish citizens, perhaps, who were trying to help out the Jews trying to reestablish the nation of Israel, and so they sent money to Nehemiah, and then he maintains his princely table in the middle of the famine. And also, he starts helping poor people, buying them out of slavery, helping people pay off their mortgages. It doesn't say that, but it does say we're going to have to buy people out of slavery. We read that in verse 8. We have to buy them back. So it sounds like he's doing that. That's reading a little bit between the lines, but It could be that Nehemiah's getting subsidies from Jews in Babylon, in Persia, wherever they were there, Mesopotamia, and then sending the money back to Jerusalem. Here's what Adam Clark says about this situation. From what is related here and in the following verse, we find that the table of the governor was always supplied by the people with bread and wine. So this Persian food allowance came from taxing the people. And that is what Nehemiah did not want to do. He did not want to make the burden on the people worse, and so he refused to take the food allowance. So the table of the governor, Adam Clark continues, was always supplied by the people with bread and wine, and besides, they had 40 shekels per diem for their other expenses. The people were also greatly oppressed by the servants and officers of the governor. But during the 12 years that Nehemiah had been with them, he took not this salary and ate none of their bread, nor were his servants permitted to take or exact anything from them. Having such an example, it was scandalous for their chiefs, priests, and nobles thus to oppress an afflicted and distressed people. Well, that's just a sneak preview Adam Clark gives us of what we read now in verses 15 and 16. Nehemiah says this, "The governors who preceded me had heavily burdened the people, taking food and wine from them, as well as a pound of silver." That means a pound of silver every day. "Their subordinates also oppressed the people, but I didn't do this because of the fear of God. Instead, I devoted myself to the construction of the wall, and all my subordinates were gathered there for the work. We didn't buy any land." Now, the governors who preceded Nehemiah, whom Nehemiah mentions in verse 15, would be the governors between Zerubbabel, who came over in 538, and Nehemiah, who came over in 445/444. Sounds like the Jews had some bad government. The government burdened the people. The governors burdened the people, taking food and wine. It says bread and wine in the NASB, but that means food in general, as taxes to pay for the governors, as well as a pound of silver. That means every day. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, NASB has 40 shekels there. That's a pound of silver. Home of Christian Study Bible has it. And then IV note, that's a good bit. The governor's subordinates also oppressed the people by requiring that food allowance. I'm sure that the governors were connived. The governors connived at that oppression with their subordinates. The governors probably sent the subordinates out and says, collect the tax, collect the food. Nehemiah says in verse 16, in contrast to all that, he says, look, I devoted myself to the construction of the wall, and all my subordinates were gathered there at the wall to work. They weren't out oppressing the people and collecting tribute from them. And I and my servants, we didn't buy any land. And what he means by that is he didn't buy any land at distressed prices, fire sale prices, because of the distress of the famine. We go now to Nehemiah 5, verses 17 through 19. Moreover, Nehemiah continues, there were at my table 150 Jews and officials, besides those who came to us from the nations that were around us. Now that which was prepared for each day was one ox and six choice sheep. Also birds were prepared for me. And once in 10 days all sorts of wine were furnished in abundance. Yet for all this I did not demand the governor's food allowance, because the servitude was heavy on this people. Remember me, O my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people. So let's look at verse 17, who Nehemiah was supporting out of his own pocket. 150 Jews. Well, who were these Jews? They were probably officials. Adam Clark says that Nehemiah kept open house, entertained all comers. Well, maybe so, but it could be Jewish officials in the kingdom, because it says 50 Jews and officials, which means that 150 Jews and officials, which sounds like the category of Jews and officials might overlap at least somewhat. And then also people came from the nations. Why were there Gentiles meeting with Nehemiah as well as Jews? As Gill says, they could have been proselytes who had come to Jerusalem to worship. They could have been business visitors who had come to Jerusalem to do business. It could have been Gentiles who Nehemiah encouraged to come to Jerusalem to give Nehemiah intelligence about what was going on in the surrounding nations. Gill suggests those three options. This is my idea. Perhaps these Gentiles were representatives of foreign nations coming in to do diplomacy with the governor, Nehemiah. Now, this was a sumptuous table, but remember, Nehemiah was a governor. He had to do this as part of his official duties, and he did it out of his own pocket. So we don't want to criticize him for living high off a hog while people were in famine. That one ox and six choice sheep that were served every day would be enough to feed 200 men. So he had to maintain his government there, feeding 200 men. Once in 10 days, all sorts of wine were furnished in abundance. That doesn't mean they drank wine every 10 days. It could be, but it most probably does not. It probably means the wine was brought in every 10 days, and they drank and drank and drank for 10 days, ran out of wine, and then another batch of wine is brought in, and they drank and drank, drank that wine until 10 days later, another batch was brought in. Now, I mentioned where all this money came from Nehemiah. I've already mentioned that he was probably, he could have been very wealthy as the cupbearer of Persia. I wouldn't doubt it. John Gill suggests another possible means of support was that Nehemiah had an estate in Judea. Well, now he'd just gotten there. Well, he'd been there for 12 years. I guess he would have time to start his own farm, and maybe he was making money off of his own farm. Now, all this that Nehemiah did was because the servitude was heavy on the people. The servitude consisted of tribute that had to be paid to the king of Persia, and also the labor and expense in building the walls. That was a terrible job, especially since they had to provide their own military support. The Persian government sure didn't do it, and it was all being done in a famine. Here's an application point here. This is a good thing to note for those who want to quit when their economy is in distress. You cannot quit. You have to keep going. Verse 19, Nehemiah finishes by saying, "Remember me, O my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people." That sounds a little braggadocious. Nehemiah certainly wasn't shy in asking God to recompense him for his charity. I kind of wonder, does that violate what Jesus said? Don't let your right hand know what your left hand is doing. Adam Clark tries to soften any criticism against Nehemiah by saying that Nehemiah did not ask for a reward from man, but rather from God. I still think it's a little cheeky. Of course, just because it's recorded doesn't mean that God approves of it, but it does sound like something that we could approve. I don't suppose it's improper for someone to pray, "God, I've tried to do my best, please reward me for what I've done." I really don't see anything wrong with that as long as you do it humbly, but it is something to think about. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Nehemiah chapter 5. We're now ready to go to Nehemiah chapter 6 in our next audio, verses 1 through 19. We will see a conspiracy rise up against Nehemiah. I hope you stay tuned for that exciting event, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.